Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
COVID-19 is a fact. It's here. It knows no boundaries. It can present anywhere at any time. We recognize that we cannot put our head in the sand and hope that it goes away. And we recognize also that being reactive is not a good policy. One could say that our federal government has had an element of reactiveness, and that has not been a good policy. So we determined to be proactive and to address this issue head on. Part of the issue is the need for acute care bed capacity. In order for that to happen, there has to be throughput into the post-acute setting. That is a necessary condition, and indeed, if they haven't already, we would anticipate that DOH is going to require the nursing home community to take residents that are recuperating from the COVID virus from the hospital setting. So we determined a couple of things. We want to be part of the solution. We are a large, a deep member of the Buffalo community. We provide a valuable service in patient throughput and bed management, and we need to continue to be able to do that even through this crisis. We also have the benefit of being in a preferred provider relationship with Kaleida Health Systems. So we have an acute care partner to help us create solutions in this environment. To that end, we have focused on Amherst as the appropriate facility to establish a dedicated subacute unit to receive COVID-positive patients that are prepared and ready to leave the acute care environment. Amherst lays out especially well to achieve this. The unit that we have created is completely isolated from the rest of the building. And then beyond that, we have taken extreme measures, both physically and operationally, to ensure that we are protecting those patients who are admitted, those employees who take care of those patients, and as well, everybody else who resides in the building and works in the building. We have created truly an isolated unit, isolated in every way, and we think that that we have done as good and complete a job in creating a safe unit, both within the unit and then within the facility as well, as is possible. We're doing this to be part of the solution. We're doing this because of a recognition of the forces of inevitability. We're doing this because we have a strong partnership with an acute care provider who helps us immeasurably in the process. We're doing this because it's the right thing to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Warren. I'm going to go in order of RSVPs. So Tom Dinke from WBFO in Buffalo, feel free to ask a question. Tom? Okay, I'm not hearing from Tom. Next up, Tracy Drury.
Hi, Chuck. How you doing? Thanks. Couple quick questions for you. First off, is this going to be the only location of yours that has a dedicated unit? And are there plans to, if there are plans to open dedicated units at your other locations, will they also be isolated and in non-connected spaces? I'm seeing some criticism already popping up on Facebook for people who work or have family members at Elderwood locations who are hearing rumors about this and already concerned about it. So can you clarify the locations and how that might roll out?
Hi, Tracy. It's Warren.
Hi, Warren.
Right now, this is the only unit that we have planned as a completely dedicated unit. We will assess the need daily as the need ebbs and flows. So far it's ebbed, it hasn't flowed, but we're watching it. The COVID virus may present itself in any facility at any time, whether it's Elderwood or any other company's facilities. And each facility will have to take the appropriate measures at that time, which may include limited isolation, particular subsections of units or a cluster of rooms. We don't know. We don't know where it will present and when. But we're watching it daily, and we will take appropriate actions as the circumstances present themselves. But at this moment, we have no other units planned.
Okay, and just a quick follow-up question. You mentioned in the press release that the state requires you to accept any patient regardless of their condition. So will patients get a choice on where they go, or if they're coming out and they're positive, this is where they'll be required to go?
Dr. Shields?
Yeah. Hi, it's Paul Shields. We are still held to all the standards that CMS and the Department of Health have in place for patient choice. We are not looking at this point to move anybody in a direction they don't want to go. We do believe from a center of excellence standpoint that the best place you can be managed if you have COVID positive symptoms will be in a unit designated to care for you. So I would hope that we would offer patients the best possible opportunity where they can receive the best care for the illness that they're presenting with. But we are not going against any CMS or state regulation with patient choice. That is still being adhered to. The process for placement and throughput is still being adhered to. We are just offering an option that will be specific to a presenting cohort of patients.
Okay. All right. So somebody's coming out of the hospital. Go ahead, Chuck.
I'm sorry. Moving on to George Rickert.
Hello. Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, George. Thanks.
Okay. Can you confirm that one employee at Elderwood Hamburg tested positive, or can you say how many positive cases you have, whether it's patients or workers in the entire Elderwood system?
Yes, George, I can confirm that we have a staff member at Elderwood at Hamburg Skilled Nursing Facility who tested positive. We received that result on Friday, the 28th of March. That employee had not worked at the facility since March 8th. And there's additional information that I can forward to you in a statement. However, beyond that, we cannot comment regard to the specific conditions of the staff member or anything with regard to identity due to HIPAA privacy regulations.
Can you say overall how many positive cases are in the system, whether it's patients or workers?
As of yesterday, I believe we have just the staff member at Hamburg and a staff member in Waverly, New York.
So you have 1,500 patients in all of your homes, 17 homes, but none of them, to your knowledge, have tested positive yet.
As of yesterday, correct.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Moving on then to Ron Plant.
All right, can you hear me?
Yes, Ron, thanks.
Could you describe a bit more about the physical barriers that actually would separate this unit from the rest of the nursing home complex? Are we talking about like negative pressure? Are we talking about actual barriers with doors, barricades? What kinds of things are you doing?
Hi, this is Becky Littler. I can speak to a little bit of the physical changes that are underway to help create some of those barriers. So we are implementing a dedicated outside entranceway to prevent individuals who may be either suspected or positive COVID coming through the general lobby of the building. So this particular entranceway will go directly to that unit. In addition to that, we have barrier doors that will prevent the commingling of residents in the long-term care section of the building to commingle with this particular unit. And we've also looked at all of our ancillary services and created alternative methods for food delivery and service of this particular unit to try to create and mitigate the spread of infection.
Would the staff, I would assume the staff will be isolated too, the workers who would actually be in there as opposed to also being connected with other staffers?
Correct. So we will, we're currently looking at our current workforce, making adjustments and identifying those healthcare workers that will be dedicated to this particular unit to prevent the commingling of individuals to the rest of the population.
Madison Elliott from Spectrum News.
Hi there. I know you guys are saying you're putting up a lot of barriers and things like that, but what do you say to the families who are just really concerned right now that their loved ones could be at risk?
Okay, Warren, I'll try to take that one. Sure. So, what we think we've instituted here, what we know we've instituted here, are extreme measures for infection control and policies and procedures for infection control. We think of them as best practices, although I'm not sure that's a defined term. But we've done everything that we can to create effective isolation, insulation, and workflow. And we believe as a result of those measures, the residents and the balance of the building are as safe or safer in this environment than in any other environment.
Now, could there still be a potential Okay. And for a follow-up question, could there still be a potential risk at all? I mean, even a little bit? And what are the ages of these patients coming in, all ages or just all elderly patients as well?
So to that, I think Becky has got our infection control on that.
So certainly the measures that we're putting into place are our goal is to mitigate any type of risk coming into the existing resident populations. However, we can't predict whether or not the virus will be introduced through a community member, a healthcare worker, but we have precautions in place. We have screening in place. We have appropriate number of PPE in place. We have infection control measures that we have reviewed over and over again, and we are prepared to manage and handle any particular type of virus that either comes to our long-term patients or the individuals that we plan to admit. As far as the age range, it is unknown at this point. We have not admitted individuals into this particular unit as of yet. But again, we stand by the health department's directive on March 25th. They issued all long-term care facilities a notice saying that no admission shall be denied, readmission, or admission to a nursing home solely based on a confirmed or suspected diagnosis of COVID-19. So we will look at each individual referral and potential person that will be referred to us for admission, and we will make decisions based on their eligibility to come to our facility.
Thank you.
Hi, Paul Shields. Can I just make one comment just to be clear about the epidemiology of this? The risk for spread across the community is what it is. The creation of this unit does not increase the risk of community spread to this building in any way, shape, or form. The creation of this unit theoretically reduces the risk of spread by isolating staff, a behavior that is not necessarily done in the space until patients are symptomatic. We're doing that presumptively and limiting. We're limiting cross-spread from others. So from a theoretical and risk standpoint, the risk of transmission in the building is reduced by the efforts that we're putting in. It does not increase the risk in any way, shape, or form. I just want to be clear that the risk is what it is. These patients in long-term care are at risk for community spread. COVID is spread across the community. We're doing efforts to reduce the risk. This effort does not increase the risk within that building.
And real quick, who just made that statement? Just so I can clarify that.
Oh, it's Dr. Paul Shields.
And Madison, if I could just dovetail onto that real quick with regards to our families. We've been in contact with the families at Elderwood and Amherst all weekend, and the health, safety, and well-being of our residents in Amherst and in all of our facilities is our top priority. This initiative was not taken lightly, and we put our best thinking and our best skills behind it. But again, our residents remain our top priority in all of this. We hope that brings some assurance to the families of our residents.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I believe Mike Baggerman from WBEN is next.
Yes. Wondering how many people are currently residing at Elderwood at Amherst, and if there's going to be any caregivers that are typically with that specific resident there that's going to be moved over to the COVID unit.
So I can't comment as to this morning the number of residents that currently reside on the particular unit that we are dedicating to COVID-19, but I can tell you that the individuals, most of the individuals on the unit will be discharging according to their normal course of rehab, and anyone who does remain, we'll work with them individually to determine the best location for the remaining residents or patients on that particular unit.
And then just on the second part of the question, how many caregivers are being dedicated to the COVID unit? Is it specifically through Elderwood, or are you guys working with Kaleida to get nurses to help take care of some of the people who have coronavirus?
At this point, this is Becky Littler again. At this point, we are confident, you know, looking at our current staffing within the building and looking and making adjustments to their particular work assignments, which makes what makes the most sense. And at this point, we don't anticipate a need to go outside of our Elderwood family for staffing assistance.
Hey, I believe Emily Stoll is on the line from B News.
Yes, I had just a question about the PPE. I know there was a press release sent recently that you were kind of spearheading a drive to get more because there wasn't enough for the nursing homes. Is that still in effect, or are you having any struggles getting enough?
Dr. Shields, do you want to take that?
Yeah, I think that we have an adequate supply of PPE at this point. I think one of the benefits of isolating a unit allows us to best resource the supplies that we have rather than the use broadly across facilities that we've seen some indiscriminate use at times. And we've also been working with Kaleida so that they will help us from a supply chain management standpoint if we have a need that we need to address to keep the residents and employees safe, that will meet that need. So I don't anticipate a problem with appropriate PPE.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
Emily, just for clarification on that appeal for PPE, that was an industry-wide appeal. So Elderwood worked in coordination with NISHPA to bring awareness for the need for cleaning supplies and PPE across the industry. Our role in that was simply facilitating it from a warehouse standpoint for drop-offs and pickups. You know, although we know that, you know, nationwide, this is a concern, but it was not, it's not expected to impact the Amherst facility at all. Lou Michelle from the Buffalo News.
Thank you, Chuck. I have a series of questions, but at the end of this conference, can you spell each person's name who's been contributing? I think we'd all appreciate that.
Sure.
So Lou, my names, first
question. I'm sorry, Lou. Those names are all
in the press release. Fine. Thank you. Thank you. I hadn't had time to look that far. So my first, I have a series of questions. My first question is, how many beds are in this isolated unit at Amherst?
This is Becky Littler. There are 22 beds.
22 beds. And you have not yet accepted anyone in, I take it, from what was previously said.
Correct.
Okay. And you're going to be receiving discharges of coronavirus patients from Kaleida Health facilities, acute care hospitals?
Yes, and we also work with all of the region's local hospitals and would accept patients from not just Kaleida, but wherever they are referred to us from.
And George Rickard had said earlier that you have 1,500 residents at your various facilities, and none of them have tested positive or shown signs. Correct.
So for clarification, Lou, that's not an exact number. It's more than 1,500 numbers, and that represents our resident population in the 17 senior care facilities in Western New York, both skilled nursing and assisted living. As of the last report yesterday, Sunday, we had no confirmed cases within any of those facilities.
A resident. You have that one employee from Hamburg.
Correct.
Okay.
So I appreciate the questions, Lou. We were really hoping to give a question and a follow-up and then one last series of questions and, again, going in order.
I understand. Can I just ask one other thing?
Sure, one more, Lou.
Yeah, okay. How many residents are showing symptoms of COVID-19?
I don't have that number.
Thank you.
Tom Dinky from WBFO, were you able to join the call?
Yes, I'm here. Sorry, I missed my window there at the beginning. Forgot to put myself off mute, but I'm here. Yes, I have a question and a follow-up, please. Just to double clarify, so the state is mandating that nursing homes take patients regardless of their COVID-19 status, but at this point, they're not necessarily mandating that you make a dedicated space and take on a certain number of them, just to clarify.
Dr. Shields?
Correct. The Department of Health has been very clear in the directive that a patient referred to subacute rehabilitation or long-term care cannot be discriminated against solely based on their COVID status. They have not clearly defined that you need to create a separate unit, but we, in good medical practice, would isolate patients and perform appropriate droplet precautions. Those patients would be appropriately managed as we accepted them into the building. But the state position is that patients should, if they're appropriate and medically stable for subacute rehabilitation, they should be transferred regardless of their COVID status.
Right. And so these COVID-19 patients will be patients that are, I suppose, well enough to be discharged from a hospital setting. So these patients won't necessarily be on ventilators. They wouldn't need ventilators in the nursing home location.
So at Amherst, we will not be ventilator capable. These are patients who, again, we are still held to the same insurance and regulatory rules for subacute care appropriateness. The same process for patient choice and screening and appropriateness for this level of care will be adhered to. The difference in this, if it's done correctly, is as we educate patients on the appropriateness of choice, this will be a facility that will mitigate risk and improve care because it's a center of excellence with staff providing care on a similar illness. Similar to the approach that the state has taken and that the federal government has taken to develop facilities for acute care within non-conventional settings, the care to deliver there is idealized by providing care to a similar cohort of patients. The thinking behind that is that we can do that well in subacute as well, and that by delivering care to a cohort of patients and mitigating risk, it also improves the level of care by reducing the number of staff that you need to expose because we're providing a consistent level of care. It is not by any means meant to subvert the process of how patients are discharged from the hospital, and a lot of patients are going to discharge from the hospital and go back to community. This is for that subset of patients that is well enough to leave acute inpatient care, but not well enough or safe to go home alone and still requires care. If the continued behaviors within the community are to not take those patients to subacute, the hospital's acute beds will become overwhelmed and bottlenecked, and we will essentially subvert all of the efforts that have been produced for the acute setting and surge preparation that we've heard so much about. This is a relief valve to move patients to the appropriate level of care and to take this with an eyes wide open, 360-degree view of these patients, taking it with all of the precautions, with excessive precautions, to keep everyone safe within the community and to allow the hospitals to provide the increased level of care they need to do. It's a significant lift, and I think that it is necessary within the community, and hopefully understanding the fact that this is a need to keep patients moving so that they can receive appropriate level of care.
Thank you.
Great. We are running a little bit short on time, but I will offer an opportunity for any last follow-up questions.
Yes, I'd like to ask.
Hey, Mike. Dr. Shields?
Sure. So the average length of stay for subacute patients is about 18 days in the subacute space. We would anticipate, and we don't have great data on this, we would anticipate that the length of stay for patients recovering from COVID is a little bit longer, only because what we're seeing is a lot of these patients are coming through the process and having significant debility, that small cohort of patients that requires extended care. So if I had to make an educated guess, I would say that anticipated length of stay is probably around 20 days for patients with COVID positive status. And in anticipation of the fact that when patients are well and we can get them back to the home community, we are also working with safe discharges to get them back to their home communities. But the period of isolation and containment doesn't change in this setting. We will most likely get patients after a 5 to 7 day hospital stay. So there'll be about a week of that containment and confinement, but we would anticipate subacute rehabilitation around that 20-day length of stay, I would anticipate.
Thank you, Dr.
Shields.
The point about PPE.
Anyone else?
PPE, again, here, if I can bring this in. You seem very confident that you're going to have adequate supplies of PPE, but constantly we're hearing hospitals around this state, around this country, saying they do not have adequate supplies of PPE. I know you're tied in with Kaleida. What more can you tell us to assure us that you would have adequate supplies, and what can you do if you run out?
Well, we're gonna make every effort to prepare. We're going to continue to ask. We're going to continue to know that we need to prepare and over-prepare for that. The CDC guidelines from a PPE standpoint are variable. I mean, there are issues that can be done that aren't necessarily mandatory that don't change your risk factor. So there, you know, there are really essentially four or five pieces of PPE. You don't need to have all five of those to continue to provide care. And the reality is we have to continue to provide care. If all the masks in the world dry up, we can't quit providing care. We can't take our toys from the sandbox and go home. So we will have to figure that out. We are committed to provide care for these residents where they choose to receive care. We will step up and meet the needs. I am confident we'll do it with appropriate PPE. If all of the PPE goes away, I don't know what we'll do, but we have to keep providing care. My hope is that we have supply chain and demand that we meet that need.
Is that Dr. Shields speaking?
Yeah.
Dr. Shields.
Thank you.
Dr. Shields, you had said that by having the dedicated unit, it will improve the level of care. Could you just expand on that a little? Please.
Sure. So we are all being forced to become, as healthcare providers, to become experts in COVID-19 management. The fact of the matter is COVID-19 management is essentially supportive care. The medications that we've talked about have been somewhat restricted. They're not going to be available to the community. They're probably not going to be available in the subacute spaces. The hospitals are going to be using those medications from a management standpoint. So what we want to do is we want to rapidly become experts in the management of this. And the best way to do that is to focus a cohort of patients so we're all receiving very similar levels of care. The comorbid disease that plays into this, the diabetes, the congestive heart failure, the COPD, the hypertension, that is all what we do every day in subacute care. So by having an isolated staff that can become experts at the assessment of lung field assessments, the experts at the staffing and management of patient symptoms. We have a tracking algorithm that we're going to work through patients to look at symptom scores and management, to watch for de-escalation and escalation of symptoms, and have care pathways that we implement from a management of those patients as we track those symptoms twice a day. We're going to watch fevers and temperatures similar to recommendations from CDC guidelines. Having that confined to one unit with a dedicated staff doing that day in and day out in intensity will by necessity improve the levels of clinical competency and confidence in managing that disease and that disease process. that's the best way to approach it. Alternatively, if we have 100 patients across the space over this point and they go to 20 different facilities, it's seemingly very difficult to control quality and outcomes and engagement when we're training staffs across 10 or 20 buildings. So theoretically, having a cohort of patients that we're managing and we're becoming a pseudo center of excellence to develop skills and best practices will provide the best care.
Is this the first one in the community, the first dedicated
subacute space, the first that I'm aware of in the community, yes.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
And I just want to clarify one other point that somebody had mentioned earlier about patients and symptoms. I think the thing we have to remember is flu season is also upon us, and we're coming out of flu season. So there are patients who are symptomatic, who have cough and congestion. I don't want anybody to think that we have buildings full of residents who have no symptoms whatsoever, but I will tell you that we're taking isolation precautions. We're moving those people from a droplet standpoint. We're keeping them and screening them. We're testing for flu and RSV and all the other respiratory illnesses that come, and we do this every year. This is what this space does. We take care of residents in 100 and 200 bed facilities that have influenza and have RSV, and we manage them very well. So I just want to be clear that we do this every year during flu season, and we have been called to do this now, and we're going to do this now, and we're going to do it well. And I think a testament to the Elderwood employees is we've asked and approached this very recently, and they've stepped up. So as much controversy and as much pushback as you may hear in the community, the Elderwood family of caregivers has stepped up and said, we will take care of these patients. There's something to be said for that.
Thank you, Dr. Shields. As you can all imagine, there's a lot going on, and we have some people who need to address some important situations. So in consideration of their time, we're going to need to wrap things up. I appreciate all of you for joining the call. Sorry we couldn't accommodate a regular press conference, but we think this is probably the most prudent. You can reach out to me for anything specific that you didn't quite capture. You all have my email and phone numbers. I believe that my office line is on the press release. If it is not, it's somewhere in my signature block. The office line today is probably the best way to get a hold of me. And that concludes our press conference. Thanks for calling in.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.